You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Monday Breakfast Show here in the studio with Rob and Edmi.
Good morning, everyone.
Feeling bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Definitely. Despite the change in daylight savings times. Hopefully everybody even though it's only been like 12 hours, it's been okay.
Yeah.
Hopefully everyone's adjusting. I always feel like, I just feel a little bit weird for a few days losing the hour of sleep?
Yeah,
losing the hour of sleep. There we go. Every year I forget how it works.
Yeah. Me too. We go through it twice a year, but everyone's always asking the same
twice questions. Every year. I'm excited for more time in the sun.
Yeah, me too. I like the evenings. I like being out at the beach, being in the parkland late. It's really nice as well.
Yeah.
Out till 9 o'clock.
I wish they were just like, okay, we've put the clocks forward. Now everyone can also leave work an hour early too. Let's just do that for the summer.
Yeah, I just had this throwback to COVID-19 when we were locked down.
But yeah.
How that would have changed things, but that was a lifetime ago at this point.
Yeah, it seems so wild. It was such an interesting time. I feel like particularly everybody here in Melbourne, it's like everybody, it was a time. Everybody went through something. Anyway, you were just listening to Think Again, a repeat, and they were, saying some very important things about the Labor government's identity crisis and current trajectory, especially as they, continue to embrace neoliberal policy, particularly within the housing area, just sort of hoping that the market will solve the problems that they're creating, instead of, rolling up their sleeves and fixing it themselves. If you do want to ever listen back to Think Again, they air live on Fridays from 10 to 10:30 a.m. or you can go to 3cr.org.au/thinkagain to listen to previous episodes of Think Again. As I said before, this is the Monday Breakfast Show, here with Rob and Edmi. This morning, until 8:30, we'll be hearing a number of different segments. We're going to start off at 7:15 after our headlines with two segments about the City of Melbourne's expansion of its CCTV program, as well as the $2 million that it's announced that will be used to put private security guards onto the grounds, the streets of the CBD. So we're going to start by hearing an interview from fellow members of the community radio network, The Wire, in which Eduardo Jordan speaks with a founding member of the Homeless Persons Union, Victoria, Patrick Cipollone, about the petition that the union has created against the aforementioned plan. And then following that, straight after that, we'll be hearing a segment about the same topic from last week's episode of Bunjil's Fire. Then, we thought we'd play a speech from yesterday's Free Palestine rally from Shamik Badra, who is a Palestinian man with a master's degree in peace and conflict studies from the University of Sydney and is also a PhD candidate at the University of Wollongong, where he researches Palestinian resistance, diplomacy, and settler colonialism. So yeah, we're very excited to air that, and yeah, really enjoyed listening to that yesterday. And following that at 7:45, we'll be joined by Jamie and Reagan, who are members of an organization called Weapons Out. They are planning a week of actions between October 20th and 24th during the weekdays with an aim to disrupt weapons manufacturers across the continent. Yeah, very excited also to have that conversation with them, and yeah, especially considering all the conversations yesterday at the Free Palestine rally about yeah, just how many weapons manufacturers and arms dealers there are locally. And at 8 o'clock, of course, this is the first Monday of the month, so we'll be bringing you a segment from our friends at the Common Social Change Library, where they'll be providing us a bulletin of some radical events over the years that changed the continent. And the show will end with, we'll replay the second part of an interview that Edmi did with Rana Hamida, who was on the Global Summit Flotilla. We originally spoke with Rana on September 1st, prior to the flotilla embarking on their journey. She is currently being held illegally in Israeli custody and is now on hunger strike against the illegal Israeli occupation, genocide, war crimes, and actions of the IOF. So yeah, we'll be playing that towards the end of the show at around 8:15. But until then, we will get into our headlines and come back to you with our first segment. Stay tuned.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah.
You're listening to 3CR at 8:55 AM, and these are the news headlines for Monday the 6th of October 2025. Youth anti-government protests in Morocco are placing authorities under increasing pressure. With Morocco set to host the FIFA World Cup in 2030 and pouring billions into expensive sporting projects, retaliation from the people has come as schools and some hospital situations around the nation continue to struggle, and there have been calls for reform. The protest has been organized anonymously online via Discord, Instagram, and TikTok by a group known as Gen Z 212, and have led to violence, including ransacking, torching of cars, civilian injury, and multiple deaths. Morocco is set to host the Africa Cup of Nations later this year, and with an election set for 2026, connections are being drawn between, quote, deep disparities in the country, with protesters chanting, quote, stadiums are here, but where are the hospitals, end quote. According to Al Jazeera, many Moroccans feel, quote, disillusioned by the growth's unevenness, with regional inequities, the state of public services, and lack of opportunity, particularly for youth, end quote.
Also in the news this week, over 1,000 artists have now joined the No Music for Genocide campaign, a cultural boycott of Israel in which artists and labels have geo-blocked and removed their music from Israel in response to the genocide Israel is committing across Palestine. Major label groups Sony, Universal Music Group, and Warner have particularly been pressure to follow suit due to their suspension of Russian operations just a month after its invasion of Ukraine began in 2022. The initiative launched in September with massive attack, Fontaine's DC, Amel and the Sniffers, and Kneecap among its first supporters. Some of its latest supporters were announced on October 3rd, including Paramore, Hayley Williams, Idols, Pine Grove, Bjork, Faye Webster, Japanese Breakfast, and Muna. The initiative said of its campaign that, quote, "This tangible act is just one step toward honoring Palestinian demands to isolate and delegitimize Israel as it kills without consequence on the world stage," end quote, and that the campaign is, quote, "borderless and open to all artists and labels who want to boycott," end quote. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR. Stay tuned.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
...3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show with Rob and Edmi. Last week in our headlines, we mentioned the City of Melbourne's expansion of its CCTV program, as well as the $2 million being used to hire private security guards. We are now going to hear 2 segments about this controversial plan. The first is an interview with fellow members of the community radio network, The Wire. In the interview, producer Eduardo Jordan speaks with founding member of the Homeless Persons Union Victoria, Patrick Cipollone, about the petition the union has created against the aforementioned plan, which we will put into the show notes of today's podcast. But until then, you can find it on change.org by searching "Melbourne City Council is criminalising homelessness. We must stop this now." Here's the interview from The Wire.
A new petition is asking the Melbourne City Council to remove security guards who are targeting homeless people in the CBD area. The Homeless Persons Union of Victoria claims this is a violation of human rights and labels homeless people as criminals. The City Council says it's part of a 4-year plan of making Melbourne the best and fairest city, with $2 million dedicated to employ security guards. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked founding member of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, Patrick Cipollone, to give an idea of what's happening in Melbourne CBD.
So earlier this year, the Future Melbourne Committee, which is a committee developed by the City of Melbourne, they wanted to improve the safety and security of their workers and the public. They claim that there are declining perceptions of safety, particularly at night, and this is really important, on public transport and by women and young people. So this is around safe on public transport, and this is particularly by women and young people. And so they engage the services of this Crown Lounge Security to improve the safety of their workers. they've employed security guards to protect what they say their local law officers while they're doing their job when it comes to begging, antisocial behaviour, drinking in public and begging. The concerns around safety at night and on public transport, the security guards won't be working on at night and they're not working on public transport. So specifically what they've identified 37 acts of violence, undefined acts of violence over 2 years to justify the $2 million they're spending on security guards to basically intimidate people with truncheons, handcuffs, and they'll be able to make citizens' arrests targeting the homeless community.
What has the reaction been from homeless Australians or members of the union about this particular issue of using community guards and targeting them?
Okay, they're demoralised. They feel intimidated. I interviewed a number of rough sleepers in the CBD a couple of weeks ago, and they're intimidated. They feel demoralised. They feel like they're not being heard. They feel like they're being targeted. The response has been they're very upset because it's an outrage. They've been set up to be the enemy when they're not. The homeless people who are experiencing homelessness in the CBD are people who've experienced severe trauma that's forced them out of their housing, especially economic inequality, because benefits are so low. Many people have lost their jobs. Many people have had breakdown in relationships that's forced them out of their housing. Many people have experienced family and domestic violence that's forced them out of their accommodation. So the other thing to remember is that all the services that support people who are homeless are located in the CBD. So that's where the laundries are. That's where the kit, you know, like access to food is. That's where the free doctors are, like the health services are all located in the CBD. So that's where they need to be if they want to be able to conduct their lives with some dignity.
Pat, could you please tell us a little bit more about the campaign or about the petition on change.org that you have running about this issue?
The Homeless Persons Union has established a petition so that we could collect signatures and also encourage people to make submissions to the City of Melbourne outlining their objections or their opposition to this draconian policy, public policy, of the use of security guards to target the homeless community. So we've encouraged people to sign a petition to put pressure on the City of Melbourne Council to abolish this policy because we think it's a regressive one. We think it's a harmful one on people's lives, especially homeless people's lives. And so we encourage people to sign the petition.
And what would you like to see instead of the guards targeting people across the CBD?
We would like to see enhanced community services, more outreach services, more access to support, like harm reduction programs for people that are using drugs, more public housing for people that are homeless, more access, drop-in services, public kitchens, public showers, public laundries where people can go so that they can improve their quality of life. Outreach workers, people who've had a lived experience, develop a relationship with people who are experiencing homelessness in the CBD. Storage. See, this is one of the issues that's creating a lot of conflict, is people are having their belongings taken by local law officers. They're doing their job, but they're taking people's stuff. And so anyone knows that when you lose your belongings, like you lose your wallet or your bedding, your sleeping bag, photos of your family, it's an upsetting situation. So they're constantly confronted with local law officers taking their belongings on a daily basis and not being able to get them back. So we would like for the City of Melbourne to establish some storage for the homeless community.
That was spokesperson from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, Patrick Schiappoloni, speaking to The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. The Wire contacted Melbourne City Council for comment.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. That was, as I said in the end of that segment, Eduardo Jordan speaking with founding member of the Homeless Persons Union Victoria, Patrick Schiappoloni, about the union's petition against the City of Melbourne's plan to put private security guards onto the street of Melbourne CBD. It's a $2 million plan. We're now going to hear a segment from last week's iteration of Bonjour's Fire, in which Uncle Robbie Thorpe spoke with Aku, a member of 44 Flats United, Meg, a lawyer and originating member of the Homeless Persons Union Victoria, as well as Fluffy, who works in harm reduction and has lived experience as a homeless person, and they're talking about the plan further.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this program, this four-year program?
So it was a pilot that's been going for 2 years, and they've just invested $2 million for the next financial year. And it is for this group called Crownland Security, which is a private security group. And it's actually quite difficult to understand what they're targeting, other than that we know that they're targeting homeless community who are using public spaces. But what they've said is their concerns are around aggressive begging, which is a bit of a contradiction in terms. Also around public consumption of alcohol, which is really concerning because the recommendations around not policing that in a coercive way come out of loss of life and tragedies that have affected our community.
And the racialized element of that kind of policing as well, is that right? With like move on laws around public drinking and the way it's targeted specifically around towards Black people, to First Nations people, there's an element of that.
I think the issue with the homeless community is that there's a massive overrepresentation of First Nations people, and there's also a massive overrepresentation of people who are have different experiences of trauma. Childhood sexual assault, family violence, childhood family violence. There's a lot of women who are homeless. There's a lot of children who are homeless. There's all kinds of vulnerabilities, and First Nations people make up a big proportion of that community. So according to the City of Melbourne's own data, it's 17%. According to some homelessness services, they'd have 33%. First Nations people who are accessing their services homeless in their own lands. So it's an inherently racialized issue, and it's also I find it particularly disturbing that it's called Crownland Security, and it's around the use of public space and what's legitimate use of public space. It's not around violent crime. It's not around things that the police would ordinarily be in charge of addressing. What the anecdotal reports we're getting, and also we're getting a lot of footage, is of, you know, groups of these private security guards standing over women and men who are homeless, you know, and that experience. I think one of the key things for the Homeless Persons Union and anyone with lived experience of homelessness is that that's a very fragile space to be living in emotionally, and that your experience of that kind of intimidation is very intense when you're so vulnerable already, because you have no home to go to. So the other thing that they've been reported to be doing is confiscating people's property and provoking people, essentially. Then they can call the police once there's a provocation, because there is no offending per se. One of the things I just want to mention about Beg Arms is that is the offence under the Summary Offences Act that they could hook. That's a legitimate criminal offence, but you can't do citizens arrests just for any old thing. Like, it's a highly risky way to, I mean, imagine if we decided, oh, let's have a gang and we'll do some citizens arrests about some issue. But with Beg Arms, homelessness is a reason why you would have that infringement knocked out in court. So it's very circular. Like, why would you be prosecuting something that the courts are going to knock out because you're homeless and you've got a special circumstance which would exempt you from that penalty? So why they're doing it, is that in the CBD, most of the properties are owned by businesses, and I think it's a prejudice issue, but I actually don't think it's the CBD itself has a broader imprint because it is the CBD. Like, they have an obligation and to the community more broadly, and I actually don't think the community more broadly would support this if they knew about it, because people want to give. It's a right to give. We have a right to give to people who are in need. That's our autonomous decision. And I just want to mention one other thing is that a lot of people are in the CBD for safety reasons because the lighting's really good, and it is safer for women and children actually to be homeless in the city. And the other thing is a lot of people are exiting prison, and we know that there's no housing options for a lot of those communities, so they're going straight in. And this type of thing, when you put it against all the other issues in terms of housing and demolition of public housing and all this stuff, highway to prison for First Nations people. So it's a full-on issue, and it's been rolled out in Maribyrnong. And I'm going to toss over to Fluffy, who knows a bit more about the community affected.
Thank you. So working within the community, we have seen a lot of Crownland Security confiscate our community members' belongings, including medication, including wallets, money, and also material aid. Services don't have enough resources to keep giving out material aid when the council keeps confiscating it. You'll often find myself and co-workers chasing after council trucks, asking for sleeping bags, asking for blankets, because we don't have the resources when they just keep taking the belongings of the our homeless community. I have seen one day walking to pick up my granddaughter from childcare, right in front of childcare, I saw two Crownland securities on the back of a homeless person pinning them to the ground. And I approached them and asked what they were doing, and they stated that that person had spat on them. I explained it does not justify the violence and the brutality of what they were doing for someone that had spat on them, because anyone that approaches anyone that's homeless, that's already a threat, whether you're don't have that intention or not. They get so much brutality from the police and from other community members outside of homelessness because of the stigma that's created around homelessness and drug use. Going back to what I was saying, I've lost a bit then. But so of course they're gonna perceive anyone that approaches them as a threat, and obviously this person felt threatened. And her defence was to, you know, to keep them back. She did spit. When I was explaining about, you know, this is not the way to approach it, sit down, have a conversation with these people. And their answer back to me was, but it was a big spit and we're going to call the police. So I asked them what their plan was, what did they want this person to do? And they stated they want this person to remain off the buildings. So they are not wanting the homeless to lean against any buildings, to go to an area that they suggested, which this day was the tram seating. So I sat down with this person. Person was petrified, in tears. I introduced myself, asked this person if they had eaten. They said no, but they'd like a drink and a cigarette. And I said, okay, I said, would you like to come for a walk with me? Let's go and get it together. At that stage, the decision was if I didn't help her move on, so-called move on, then they were going to arrest her. So I took her for a walk to Tobacconist and Coles. We got something to eat, and they were following us. Crownland Security were following us. They said they'll be calling the police, and I said that was absolutely unnecessary. She's moved off the building. Police arrived. The Crownland Security assured me that she would not be put in cuffs, this person, would not be arrested. I overheard, I think 15 police turned up at that stage. I overheard a police officer say, I'm going to put her in cuffs. So I approached that police officer and advised them what the conversation was with Crownland Security, and they came over and asked my permission to take a photo of this person for their records. And I said, I don't have authority to give that permission. You'd have to ask that permission that person directly. She stated no. They took a photo anyway. And then they went on their way, and she had to sit on the tram seats. Otherwise, the police were coming back to arrest her. That's one of many, many, many stories I've witnessed. Not only working in the sector, but also personally as well.
The state government has sold 578 hectares of public land to private developers. They're building private-public partnership model housing over public housing land, and it's just not on.
Housing is just massively expensive. It's never been effective in this country to rely on the market to provide decent housing for people.
Rent has risen by 21%. That's median rent across the country as of January this year.
As the rents keep rising, so must we. And we must stand together as a collective, because this war cannot be won by the few. It will only be victorious by the many.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. Just before that CSA, we were listening to Aku, Meg and Fluffy joining Uncle Robbie Thorpe on last week's Bungle Fire Show, talking about the City of Melbourne's $2 million program to put private security guards on the streets of Melbourne CBD and the effect that it is having on those experiencing sleeping rough in and amongst the CBD and the homelessness community. Up next, we'll be playing a speech from yesterday's Free Palestine rally. Shamik Badra is a Palestinian man who holds a master's degree in peace and conflict studies from the University of Sydney and is a PhD candidate at the University of Wollongong, where he researches Palestinian resistance, diplomacy and settler colonialism. His publications in professional journals cover appraisals of academic theory and activism to advance global solidarity for Palestine. His nonviolent work includes a theoretical framework for the Great March of Return and leadership to foster Palestinian unity. Have a listen.
Thank you so much. As a Palestinian, and I am also from Gaza, I'd like to thank you. I appreciate your solidarity. I appreciate organizing this rally to stop the genocide in Gaza. Thank you so much. I want to salute the brave people of the global Sumud Flotilla. These humanitarian activists represent the best of humanity. They sailed to show real solidarity with Gaza and bring food to starving families, because our governments have failed to help the people in Gaza. Just days ago, Israeli forces kidnapped seven unarmed Australian activists. Shame. Yeah. This is a crime. We say clearly, these activists must be free, and the Australian government must act, place sanction on Israeli colonial state, expel the ambassador and Mossad staff, stop all weapons to Israel, and finally reflect the will of the Australian people. Comrades and friends, we don't trust the American proposals. And now they are talking about ceasefire. This is what we want. But at the same time, if Israeli occupation didn't withdraw, the Palestinians will continue its resistance, and we will not give up until to achieve our goals in liberation. As you know, on September 16th of September, Israeli began ground invasion of Gaza City. This is a family place. After weeks of bombing, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been forced to leave with no safe place to go. Hospitals are collapsing, high buildings have been bombed into rubble, having leaving families buried under the ruins. These attacks are not random. They are a part of a plan to expel Palestinians and continue the process of elimination through destruction of homes and neighborhoods, mass killings, and forcing people to leave Gaza to complete the ethnic cleansing. Yes, shame. Yes, Gaza is suffering, but Gaza is not defeated. Gaza will still fighting. And here is the truth. Even Israeli leaders have admitted the power of resistance. Moshe Dayan said, for every child in a refugee camp, for every family evicted, there will be another generation that will never give up the right of return. So this is acknowledgement of them about the power of resistance. The criminal Ariel Sharon admitted that Palestinians are not going anywhere. They will not surrender. They will not disappear. This is truth. Yitzhak Rabin said, we can break their bones, but we can't break their spirit. I wish I could wake up one day and find that Gaza had sunk into the sea. But they failed, and Gaza still fighting. They may boast that Gaza is burning, but Gaza hasn't burned. Gaza stands, Gaza resists. For me, this is not politics. I am not going to talk about theories. It's personal experience. My own mother is still trapped in Gaza. Most of my family has been killed. I live every day with this pain, but still I say, we will never give up. This struggle is not new. Since the Nakba of 1948, Palestinians have faced massacres, displacement, and exile. But every time, we stood up again. That is why they call Sumud. This is why Palestinians is still fighting forever, but until to achieve our goals in liberation and freedom. And solidarity is our strength. When my brother wore the kufiya in Sydney train, we were attacked by racists and told to go back to your country. They wanted to scare us, but everyone in Australia answered, you belong, we stand with you. This is solidarity. That is why the kufiya is powerful, more than merely scarf. It's a global symbol of resistance. Kufiya is symbol of our history, our dignity. And to wear it, I will not be silent. I carry Palestine and Gaza in my heart. Comrades and friends, we have heard the bombs. We have seen the rubble. We live the loss every day. My mother is still trapped in Gaza. So many of my family are gone, and yet we will stand, we will continue this struggle. Gaza is suffering. Gaza is not defeating. Gaza resists. We carry that resistance with us in every kufiya raised, in every act of solidarity, in every voice that say, you belong, we will not be silenced, we will keep fighting for justice, for children, for the right of return. So stand with us, organize, protest, welcome refugees, challenge racism, keep showing up. Solidarity is stronger than bombs. Together, we are unbreakable. Yes. Yes.
They tried to ban Gaza. They tried to arrest Palestine, but you can't arrest people who refuse to disappear. Gaza stand and we stand with it. To the martyrs, we remember you. To the children, we will fight for your future. To Gaza, you are not alone. Palestine is not only in Gaza or in the West Bank. It is here, in Sydney, in every kufiya raised high. I am proud to be Palestinian and proud to be from Gaza. The kufiya is our dignity, our history, our strength. No attack, no racism can erase that. So yes, Gaza suffers. Gaza not surrender. Gaza resist. And even our oppressor admitted, we will not disappear, we will not break, we will not die in silence. Thank you so much, comrade.
And that was Shamik Badra speaking at yesterday's Free Palestine rally held outside the State Library and the Australian Future Fund. Tomorrow, Tuesday, the 7th of October, marks 2 years since Gaza was bombarded and this phase of the genocide began. Tomorrow, the Palestinian community will gather to honour the loved ones killed by Israel, to join the Palestinian community in commemoration of the first day of Israel's genocidal escalation. There will be a procession held outside the MPA Pavilion on St Kilda Road, starting at 5 p.m, followed by a 6:30 p.m. ceremony held outside Parliament House in Spring Street. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, also streaming live on the Community Radio Plus app and on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. We thought we'd also just take a second to mention the investments that the Future Fund, which is Australia's $250 billion sovereign wealth fund, has put into defence companies. An article from The Guardian has exposed that the Future Fund has increased its investments into Elbit Systems by 449% between October 2023 and June 2025. In October in 2023, $488,768 was invested in Elbit Systems, and since then it has now increased to over $2.6 million. Of course, Elbit Systems describes itself as the backbone of the IOF's drone fleet. As well as the investment in Lockheed Martin, which is a US headquartered company that also helps to produce the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, increased its investments by 23% from $71 million to $88 million between October 2023 and June 2025. I also just want to mention some excellent reporting from Declassified Australia, which they have managed to get hold of some confidential shipping records, and they show that a total of 68 shipments of F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft parts have been sent to Israel from Australia between October 2023 and September 2025. Of the 68 documented shipments, 51 had been marked, with the final receiver being at Nevatim, located in Israel, which corresponds with the address of the Nevatim airbase located in the Negev Desert, and the base for Israel Air Force's three F-35 squadrons. So we can put the link to both of those articles in the show notes for later reading. I encourage listeners to, remember that there are arms dealers and weapons manufacturers in your local area. The Australian government is complicit. And on that note, we are now going to be joined by Jamie and Reagan, who are members of Weapons Out. They're an organization behind a week of actions taking place between October 20th and 24th to disrupt said weapons manufacturers across this continent. They aim to slow down the supply chain for genocide and reveal the company's complicit in the US-Israel war machine. Jamie and Reagan, why don't you start by maybe telling us what country you're both on and, more about the Weapons Out actions that you have planned?
Cool. So I'm Jamie and I'm on Wadawurrung country in the state of Victoria in Jilang, otherwise known as Geelong.
Yeah, and
Reagan, do you want to?
Yeah, I'm on a Awabakal country.
Tell us about the Weapons Out action that you have planned from October 20th to 24th. What does that entail?
Okay, it'd be good if we could just maybe give a little bit of background to how this has come about.
Sure.
We're 2 years into this horrific Israeli genocide in Palestine now. And, you know, huge weekly rallies in capital cities and a range of other actions around the country that have happened from time to time have not stopped weapons exports to Israel from this country. And the government continues to lie about the fact that weapons and components are being exported to Israel. They often go via other countries, in particular the United States, but they end up in Israel, we know that, and they're being used against the Palestinians. And more recently, thanks to declassified Australia, we now know that some components are being exported directly to Israel. And very recently, we discovered that in some cases, passenger airliners are transporting those weapons in the cargo hold. So we feel that after all of the actions that have occurred for 2 years that has not stopped these exports of weapons and components, we now need to undertake direct action, take matters into our own hands and do whatever we can do to disrupt production at these factories and to slow down, stop the exports. So we feel that what's needed now is a nationally coordinated waves of direct action against manufacturers of weapons and components. And this 20th to the 24th of October will be the first wave. We know that many people who regularly go to rallies are feeling the need to do more and they're ready and willing to escalate, but often just don't know what to do or who to contact. And some of those people participated in the recent nationally coordinated and supported but decentralised wave of occupations at federal ALP members' offices. And that model worked really well and it gave people the confidence to take more transgressive action. We feel that stopping weapons and components exports will require mass ongoing civil disobedience and disruptive action. So that's what this first wave of action is all about.
And what did the other two waves of action entail?
Well, we can't tell you yet. but it'll be, I mean, what you will see is an increasing escalation over time. So but I can't really say any more about that at this point.
What's happening at the current stage is that people quite experienced with direct action are forming up for this wave. It's the weapons out of everywhere. campaign. So we're calling on people to join campaigns in their area, and there's support being offered to those who are organising campaigns in whatever way that they need support. So that's a big part of this first wave, is supporting people who are wanting to come on board, take more direct action, and move forward in this wave together in a supported way.
I think you both have sort of mentioned it on your answers to the first question, but maybe you'd like to talk about, yeah, obviously the mainstream media and politicians go to pretty good lengths to continue to portray that, like, F-35 parts are made in Australia, but they're quote-unquote non-lethal parts, which we obviously know is a lie, because what's a non-lethal part of a fighter jet, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, Jamie, you did mention the reporting, the great reporting from Declassified Australia. So maybe you both would like to talk about, yeah, how else you find out sort of, yeah, where the weapons dealers and manufacturers are in your local area.
Yeah, well, look, there are a number of the weapons companies themselves, using their website to find out information is one great way. There are some organisations that have really kind of specialised in gathering this information. So Wage Peace Disrupt War is one of those, Renegade Activists, Albert Out of Victoria, those groups have done a lot of research and pulled a lot of that information together. And in fact, on the Wave Peace website, there is a link to where you can find the weapons dealers near you. It's kind of broken down into geographical areas. But basically what we're doing is some people are already well linked to other activists in their area and others are not. So we're trying to link people in with sort of existing groups of people, and those existing groups are already generally pretty well across where the weapon manufacturers are in their area.
I also wanted to talk about, obviously, the campaign puts an emphasis on autonomous action. Why do you both think that autonomy is important in this context?
Mm-hmm. Reagan, do you want to answer that, or I'm happy to?
You can go for it, I'll think on it.
Well, I guess because, you know, Australia is just so huge, you know, physically, geographically, and we're all spread all around the country, that groups, it's about acknowledging, I guess, that activists and groups of activists that are already huge, they have the local knowledge in their area, and they know what works, what doesn't work, because they've tried things. So, and also, it's about empowering activists and empowering groups. Our role, the coordinating team's role, is really just to provide a point of contact and support. And support involves, so we're running some training stuff, we've got some online resources that people can use. If people need a particular help with a particular thing, we can link them up with people who've got that particular skill so they can get some guidance and support around that. But at the end of the day, it's up to local communities to, you know, be aware of what's going on in their town and to take action against it. So it's important that those communities and those groups, you know, have the power, the decision-making power, to do that autonomously.
Autonomous action allows for a decentralised organising structure. So this isn't one group making decisions and asking other people to enact those decisions. It's a wide variety of people who've done a lot of work over the years to identify what's happening in our backyard, the weapons that are being manufactured. And they have plenty of ideas and experience on how to take action against that weapons manufacturing. They're able to support others to organise those actions within those areas, and it only makes sense for a local to do that level of organisation, the local organising. So all the support is there to take that step forward. We just need local people on the ground who are wanting to take that step forward and take direct action to link in and join this wave and get weapons out of everywhere.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. We are on the line with Jamie and Regan, who are members of the Weapons Out organization, which is behind a week of actions taking place between October 20th and 24th across the continent to disrupt weapons manufacturers. So maybe let's talk about the sort of infrastructure that Weapons Out have set up. So you mentioned before about the Wage Peace website to help people track down where the weapons manufacturers or dealers are in their area. We can, of course, include a link to that in the show notes of the podcast we published for the show.
That would be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But how else do people reach out to get support? And maybe you'd also like to talk about some of the stuff happening here in Nam and elsewhere across so-called Victoria.
So Disrupt Wars has an Instagram account, and that has already, you know, advertised and promoted this week of action. So people can send a message to us via that Disrupt Wars Instagram account. They can also contact us by emailing weapons out of here, so outer spelled O-U-T-T-A, weapons out of here at proton.me. So they can contact us via those two ways. And we have, you know, an encrypted messaging chat that we're using that we can bring people into once they reach out to us via either of those methods. And from there, we can find out where they're located, you know, whether they're already linking with a group or not, and then link them up with others. And then the other thing about the social media is, and about just getting involved is, you know, for those who maybe want to contribute but perhaps who can't be involved in, like, frontline direct action due perhaps to health issues or disabilities, or maybe people who feel they want to take a step up but they're not quite ready to undertake frontline direct action, there are all sorts of support roles that people can do to help and support this wave of action. There's media, there's care teams, there's lots of different stuff that people can do. So what we want to encourage is for people to get involved at whatever level they're comfortable with. But we just want people to get involved because, as I said earlier, it's going to take huge numbers of us, you know, consistently disrupting these weapons manufacturers in order to get any kind of outcome. In terms of what's going on in Nam, there are lots of activists in Nam around the place, and so there's like more than one group, and there's plenty of weapons manufacturing going on. There's plenty of weapons manufacturing going on in Geelong, where I am, and in other parts of regional Victoria. I can't go into specifics about anything that's planned, but there are very exciting actions, you know, being developed as we speak.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show, Jamie and Regan. Is there anything else that either of you wanted to add about, the campaign or other actions?
Not me. It's just to say to people, it's time to step up. It's time to escalate. We must escalate to stop this horror that's going on in Gaza. And I want to add to that, things are escalating. People are taking action. You can join them. The movement is happening. It's rising. People are escalating now. There are so many ways to support that escalation. If you can't be on the ground, you can be behind the scenes. There's so many ways to support this action. If you are against weapons being manufactured in your backyard to slaughter Palestinians and other oppressed people around the world, contact us.
Thank you so much for that. And best of luck with the campaign. Thank you wonderful. So much for joining us.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, Rob.
Tricia, your station, your voice.
Palestine is not just the land of the Muslims. It's the land of three people and all people. The land of the Muslims, the land of the Christians, and the land of the Jews who are decent and not Zionist Jews. When we say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that does not mean that we are going to get rid of the Jews from that land. We are saying there's going to be one state of Palestine, the historic Palestine, where the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims can live side by side peacefully.
3CR, your station, your voice.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. We were just joined by Jamie and Regan, who are members of Weapons Out, an organization behind a week of autonomous actions between October 20th and 24th to disrupt weapons manufacturers across the continent. As we mentioned in the interview, you can go to wagepeaceau.org/weaponsmap. To find the arms dealer or manufacturer in your area. You can get into contact with Weapons Out at Weapons Out of Here. That's Weapons and Out of Here, OUTTA, at proton.me to get involved. And as we mentioned, we'll put links into the articles about the Future Fund's investment into weapons companies, as well as Declassified Australia's reporting on the F-35 parts pipeline in the show notes. And now we are going to hear a new segment from our comrades at the Common Social Change Library. This is Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, a bulletin bringing you some radical events over the years that changed so-called Australia. This feature is looking at the month of October over our collective history, and will come to listeners on the first Monday of every month at 8 a.m. It is a good example of why we need to remember our history in order to build a better future.
Tiny Sparks and Turning Points is a monthly selection of protests, strikes and significant dates concerning social change in Australian history. This segment is presented by the Commons Social Change Library, a repository of more than 1,500 resources for campaigners, which can be found at commonslibrary.org.
On the 1st of October 1968, New South Wales' first ever teachers' strike was held to demand improved work conditions and increased funding for education.
On the 1st of October, but in 2004, refugees, peace activists and others picketed the Melbourne Arts Centre in disgust at Foreign Minister Alexander Downer being invited to address a symposium on Iraq and human rights challenges. Despite avoiding a giant rat trap laid at the entrance, the politician was still served with a citizen's warrant to answer for crimes relating to the invasion of Iraq and the torture of its people.
On the 3rd of October 1927, Aboriginal activists petitioned the New South Wales government, calling for an end to the forced removal of their children.
On October the 4th, 1956, Queensland's Premier Vincent Gehr declared a state of emergency in an attempt to force striking shearers back to work.
4,000 secondary students from 45 Brisbane schools struck on the 5th of October 1995 to protest against French nuclear testing in the Pacific.
On the 7th of October 2012, mining company ECI International gave up its license to explore for coal seam gas in a 500-kilometre area covering Colac and the Otway Ranges. This followed a series of packed public meetings throughout the region, as well as planned direct action.
ABC journalists in New South Wales struck for 24 hours on October the 8th, 1978, after an interview with one of the leaders of their union was censored by management.
On the 9th of October 1989, police evicted members of the Noongar community and their supporters who had been occupying sacred land at Gunninup on the banks of Perth's Swan River. Despite this, union bands and community pickets continued to halt destructive redevelopment until August 1992.
From the 9th to the 11th of October 2019, a spring rebellion saw scores of disruptive actions across Australia draw attention to the need for immediate climate action. In Melbourne, Extinction Rebellion activists took part in disco disruption actions that blocked streets and featured choreographed performances to the tune of the Bee Gees' Staying Alive. In Adelaide, climate rebels, dancing to the 70s disco classic Nutbush City Limits, halted traffic outside the State Administration Building, forcing the South Australian Premier to, quote, face the music.
On the 12th of October 1874, a crowd of 300 people gathered outside Castlemaine Jail to greet nine tannery workers who had been sentenced to a week in jail for, quote, absenting themselves from the hired service of George Cunnock. All had requested that they either be employed on the basis of an eight-hour day or be free to look for work elsewhere. Their employer insisted that they continue to work 60 hours a week for him. When they refused to do so, they were charged and convicted under the Repressive Masters and Servants Act. Led by a brass band, unionists and supporters marched through the Victorian town and held a public meeting that denounced the, quote, injustice, namely that a master may break a contract with impunity, but a servant only at the peril of imprisonment.
From the 12th of October 1944, striking printers and journalists in Sydney produced nine issues of their own newspaper, selling over 100,000 copies.
Unemployed protesters and supporters occupied the Elite Melbourne Club on October the 12th, 1982, to hold a luncheon protest against poverty.
On October the 13th, 1994, garbage collectors in Brisbane ended a six-day strike over the removal of rest breaks.
A 24-hour transport strike was held on October the 14th, 1946, as part of a national campaign to bring an end to wartime wage controls.
The opening of the Australian ballet season was cancelled on October the 15th, 1970, after dancers held their first ever strike. Following this action and a picket of the Canberra Theatre, management quickly agreed to improve wages and conditions.
On the 15th of October, 1972, demonstrators marched 6 kilometres from the Carlton football ground to Pentridge Prison to show their support for activists who had been jailed for resisting military conscription.
On the 15th of October, but in 2006, cleaners rallied in all Australian capitals on International Anti-Poverty Day to support the Clean Start, Fair Deal for Cleaners campaign.
Thousands of university staff struck across Australia on the 16th of October 2003 against attacks on their unions.
Students at Marion High School in Adelaide struck on October the 17th, 1980, against the continuing use of corporal punishment.
With the lease on the United States Pine Gap spy base up for renewal in 1987, hundreds of protesters made their way to Alice Springs to take part in a convergence against nuclear war and militarism, and for peace and land rights. The peak of the protest came on the 19th of October, when more than 600 people gathered at the base's gates to hear local Aboriginal people and peace activists from across the country and around the world give speeches and read out an eviction notice. Anti-nuclear Senator Joe Valentine was arrested for attempting to deliver this document to military personnel, and a further 97 people were arrested for entering the base. A group of 10 grandparents, including Aboriginal activist Mum Shirl, were arrested the following day during another attempt to deliver the eviction notice.
During October 1985, Australian unions carried out industrial bans targeting the racist regime then in power in South Africa. These bans covered aviation, shipping, building, mail, telecommunications and other industries. They were capped off with a march and rally in Sydney outside South African Airways on October the 21st.
Sick and tired of government and union foot-dragging and echoing the struggles of the British suffragettes, Zelda Duprano chained herself across the doors of the Commonwealth Building in Spring Street, Melbourne on the 21st of October 1969 to demand equal pay for women.
The weekend of 22nd and the 23rd of October 1977 saw more than 50,000 people rally around Australia against uranium mining.
In 1977, the Victorian State Government announced its plan to demolish a number of residential homes in Melbourne's inner north to make way for the construction of the F19 freeway. A coalition of residents and political activists came together with the local council to resist the resulting wave of compulsory evictions. Over a period of months, the anti-freeway campaign saw Alexandra Parade transformed into parkland before a brick wall was constructed across the site on October the 24th. Barricades built out of cars and scrap material were also erected to slow the pace of construction. Although the blockade was eventually broken and the freeway completed, the protests achieved victories further afield, with proposed road projects cancelled and planning processes reviewed.
On October 26, 1848 in Launceston, a public meeting of artisans, mechanics and others was held to form a league whose members pledged not to employ convict labour after the next harvest. This came in the context of 12 petitions being submitted to Queen Victoria calling for an end to convict transportation to the colony.
On the 26th of October, but in 1990, 700 women marched from Hyde Park to King's Cross as part of annual Reclaim the Night events, opposing violence against women and expressing the right to walk the streets without fear. Marches had first been held in Sydney and Perth in 1978 and then spread to other parts of the country.
In their first statewide strike ever, Queensland Ambulance personnel stopped work on the 26th of October 2005 to demand improvements in staffing and conditions.
5 days of strikes and protests by convicts at the Parramatta female factory peaked on the 27th of October 1827 when women broke down the gates, escaping into the bush and fighting soldiers and constables in the streets. This followed months of unrest over harsh punishments, poor rations and the gruelling living and working conditions that inmates and other women assigned to the workhouse had to endure. Following skirmishes, many women returned to the factory, but only after authorities agreed to restore rations and allow them to keep any food that they had requisitioned from nearby shops. Around 100 initially escaped, and 4 days later, 19 women remained at large. The final escapees would not be located until December. 5 further uprisings took place before the factory was turned into an asylum in 1848.
2,500 secondary school students struck against education cuts in Canberra on October the 27th, 1994.
On the 28th of October, 1916, a narrow majority of Australians voted against the introduction of military conscription in a national referendum. Although Prime Minister Billy Hughes's federal government officially had the power to introduce compulsory military service, the depth of opposition had forced them to seek a mandate. In the end, concerted campaigning ensured that this was not forthcoming. Defying restrictions on free speech, activists sang banned anti-war songs, distributed illegal pamphlets, and organised scores of rallies and meetings.
Incensed at the defeat, Prime Minister Billy Hughes left the Australian Labor Party, passed draconian anti-protest laws, and instituted a crackdown on the vehemently anti-war industrial workers of the world. Nevertheless, conscription was again rejected at a second referendum in 1917.
You've been listening to Tiny Sparks and Turning Points. The segment will return next month. In the meantime, to find out more about the history of social change in Australia, you can visit commonslibrary.org.
You're listening to The Monday Breakfast Show. Thank you so much to our comrades at the Commons Social Change Library for providing us with another bulletin talking about radical events over the years that changed the country. You can find their work at commonslibrary.org, as they said, and look out for their page on the 3CR website, which we will feature if you want to listen back, which will be coming soon. The Commons Social Change Library also has more events that they mentioned in the bulletin called From Little Things, Big Things Grow. We will put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Up next, we'll be playing part two of an interview with Rana Hamida of the Global Samud Flotilla, originally played on the 1st of September prior to the flotilla embarking on the journey to open a humanitarian aid corridor through the Mediterranean Sea and into Gaza. As most of you listeners are probably aware by now, the flotilla journey through the sea has ended, and there were many, many arrests by the IOF, the Israeli occupation forces, including Rana, and they were abducted in international waters and were being held captive in prison. I saw a post that said a number of, maybe 137 off the top of my head, of the prisoners had been released. I'm not sure if this is true, so don't quote me on that. But Rana is a Palestinian woman and a citizen of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and she's currently on hunger strike against the Israeli occupation, which I think in terms of activism, in terms of acts of resistance, is incredible. And with the amount of information that is saturating our ears and eyes nowadays, I think it's worth noticing, taking real notice of what's happening there. Have a listen.
Yeah, well, here in Naarm in Melbourne, where 94, 95 consecutive weeks, the Palestinian people here have been leading us in solidarity, and we've been coming together and marching and protesting. So the fire that you feel is a fire that is well and truly on the way here. It's building.
It is so inspiring. I've seen the big marches on the bridge in Sydney. It is so amazing. So it's so inspiring, and it's inspiring us back here in Aotearoa, not here where I am right now, but back home where I live and where my family and friends are in Aotearoa. It's inspiring us, and to the point that we are now organizing our own. And I am going to be in the sea at the same time that my comrades and my siblings and my sisters and my brothers are going to be holding the land in Aotearoa and Taumati Makaurau. So thanks for the inspiration, and just know that what happened in Australia, acknowledging the people of the land in Australia as well, and the indigenous people of that land, and acknowledging their struggle too. But that is a movement. It's a movement. It's a torch that, whenever we light that torch, it continues to spark the light and the flames of the next and the next. So it continues. It is an active motion of love and solidarity and remembrance. So thank you so much for doing that. I am so excited to come to Australia at some point and share and join. And inshallah, at that point, we don't need to do all of these things. But this is just the start, because there is a lot of oppression around the world, and we want to stand for all of that. It is not for one or another. It's not selective.
Well, as you said, Rana, the global movement to Gaza is a coordinated mobilization by land, sea, and air, united by the belief that the genocide has to end now, and, well, yesterday. How many boats are going in this flotilla, and what is the best-case scenario if you're able to open up this humanitarian corridor and get aid into Gaza?
We have been planning and organizing as many boats as we can, And it is a very, very strategic and calculated process because you want to have the safest amount and formation of ships that will guarantee us safety passage, which would have hopefully, which is our aim, is to lead into safe passage into Gaza shores, far further away from it, for us to drop the aid and then create that humanitarian corridor for ships to come and continuously bring aid through the sea. Of course, that does not happen by just like that, because we can see the Israeli regime is acting with complete impunity, and their actions are not precedented per se. So we are relying on the community of the world and on our governments that do have our political passports in mind, you know, that we need their voices, we need them to stand up, we need them to speak up and pressure the Israeli regime to open and allow a safe passage for this humanitarian fleet of ships carrying essential aid and nothing more. So that also, as far as we can see, and we have been experiencing for 2 years or over 2 years right now, is that our governments won't do that on their own. So we do call upon the communities and the humans and everyone, everyday person that goes to their work every day and experiences the joy of life and feels what's happening right now and feels the oppression and the inhumane, unjust behavior that is being implicated on the Palestinian people in Gaza and also on the West Bank, to stand up and to apply pressure on their governments and their officials and their local governments and countries, because we need all of us on deck right now. For the best scenario to happen, we need everyone to be active, we need everyone to speak up, and just keep on going, basically. So right now we are believing and we are hoping that our mission would go through the sea, reach the borders around Gaza and deliver the aid. And then that would create that peaceful flow of humanitarian corridor that will be secured for more aid to go in. As we know, the aid that is allowed to go in is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what the Palestinian people right now need. So we need as much help and support to allow the essential aid to arrive to the people that desperately need it at the moment.
We have time for one last question, Rana. Here in Australia and New Zealand, and for our listeners, how can they show support behind the flotilla movement? And how can they track and get involved? Are you on Instagram? Are you on social media? Is there ways that we can watch what you're doing?
Yes. So first, about keeping updated. Now, this is very important because every day in such a mission carries so much more updates that comes through. A lot happens. And we have participants, as I said, from over 40 countries, so 44 countries. And in our delegation, we have joined Aotearoa and Australia together as one delegation, and we are here together as one voice. What you can do is you can follow the people that have been on the mission, check on their social media, follow the official one for the delegation, which is globalmovementtogaza.aunz. Mm-hmm. When you follow that, you will see updates from most of the team that is going public about it, and they are posting about it. The official spokespeople can do interviews, so amazing humans like you can amplify the message. If you're a person that you feel like, oh my God, I don't have a radio, I can't do all of that, blah, 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 join your local protest. Join your voice. Your voice matters. Your voice is one that is not separate of a very big movement, and you're not alone. So go to your next activation next to you in your region, gather your friends and go talk about it. Have this difficult conversation that sometimes it's really hard to have because you feel like, oh, do I know enough? Can I talk about this? What if they signal me out? Talk about it, because it's very important. If we don't do it right now, then when? And pressure your MPs, talk to them. Check who are your local MPs. Go to them, find their email address. And you know what? It can be even easier if you find your local solidarity group And once you find this group, you can ask them, and they probably are putting the work to reach out to MPs and join them. You don't have to do this alone at all. At all, because there is big solidarity groups locally in a lot of places. We have one in Aotearoa, we have in Tamaki Makaurau, we have in Ōtautahi, we have in Dunedin, and I'm pretty sure that in Australia you have so many different organizations, and I'm sure that once you write Palestine in Australia, you will find so many different organizations and groups that are working tirelessly to amplify the voice of the Palestinian people. So join them, amplify, talk about it, join your protest next door, talk to your MPs and pressure them. They need a push. Your MPs are there because you voted them there. So they need a reminder of why and who voted them there and for what, so they don't forget the role and their responsibility. So follow this mission, share it, talk about it, join it next time. Next time, join it, because this is not going to be the last one. We are just opening a movement, a global movement for oppression. Oppressive systems should not have a place within our communities at these times. So we are the people. We are the people. We are the voice that will rise up to change this and create a new paradigm, a paradigm where people have equal human rights, where there is respect and justice and freedom of practice of your life, of experiencing life, of breathing the air, of working on your land, and of choosing whether you want to leave this land and go and live in the city or just stay in your humble little house. So we all deserve this. And just ground back into this remembrance, and within your mind, within your thoughts, just notice how the oppressive systems come up whenever you be like, oh, I'm going to go and join this, and then you feel the doubt and the fear. This is the oppressive system. So work with that and notice it and be aware of it and amplify and be there. Be with us.
Rana Hamida, thank you so much for your time. That's all we have time for. From 3CR, we wish you safe passage on your journey, to you and everyone else among this flotilla. And we hope that you are able to successfully get aid into Gaza.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for all the team that is working tirelessly behind your channel. And thank you for all the people that are standing up. And thank you for the Global Samut Flotilla and all the different organizations that are part of it. And all the humans that are working for no return other than responding to the uttermost inspiration that we have, and the people that we feel within our hearts, the Palestinian people, we are coming and we are hearing and we're listening. So thank you so much, and I hope that we speak again.
For more information and updates on the current status of Rana and the members of the Global Samud Flotilla, go to globalmovementtogaza.aunz on Instagram. The page includes ways to take action in support of the flotilla members being held captive by the Israeli occupation forces, including the numbers, names, and email addresses of political and government ministers through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, parliamentary officers, and the relevant embassies for each flotilla member in their country. Soon, through some community, we'll be doing a fundraiser for Rana to raise money for her psychological well-being and self-care once she's released and, I suppose back home. That's all we got time for today. So time for the post-show rundown. We started off today's show with a segment from The Wire where Community Radio Network and interview producer Eduardo Jones spoke on the founding members of the Homeless. He was a founding member of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, Patrick Cipollone, and they discussed the petition the union has created against the aforementioned plan to expand CCTV programs in the city and hire private security guards. And we followed that with an interview that was aired on last week's episode of Bundles Fire with Robbie Thorpe. We heard stories about the excessive use of force used by Crownland security guards who are being hired to stamp out homelessness in the CBD and Maribyrnong Council, for example. Following that, we heard a speech from Shamik Badra at yesterday's Free Palestine rally. After that, we had a phone interview with Rob, Jamie and Reagan, members of Weapons Out, an organization behind a week of actions between October 20th and 24th to disrupt weapons manufacturers across the continent. Then we heard a segment from our friends at the Commons Social Change Library, Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, where we heard key points of social change and protests and activism throughout the years here in Australia. And finally, we heard part two of an interview with Rana Hamida from the Global Summit Flotilla from the 1st of September, which we replayed. From Rob and I, Edmi, here on Monday Breakfast Show 3CR. Thank you very much. Hope you have a good day.
And stay tuned for Women on the Line.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.